You got the touch. You got the power. Yeah.
You are listening to Screenfish Radio. I'm your host, Steve Norton. And on this, the last day of 2018, we are going back to the year 1987 to take a look at Bumblebee. The latest entry into the Transformers franchise is wildly different from previous films, focusing more on character and the emotional journey. Bumblebee tells an intimate story more akin to the Amblin films of the 1980s. But is a film like this too little too late? Or does it, as Stan Bush's iconic theme suggests, still have the touch? In this episode, we are thrilled to have the author of Watching Movies, Watching Stories, Troy Kinney, join us as we take on giant robots, what it means to let go, and what it means to be human. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Screenfish Radio. We are thrilled that you could be here this week as we talk about Bumblebee, the latest and arguably first real Transformers movie in the franchise. This week, we are thrilled to have a newbie to the podcast, Troy Kinney, author of Watching Movies, Watching Stories. Welcome, Troy. We're so glad you could be with us here today.
Thank you so much. I love to be here.
Well, we're glad you could join us, and we're looking forward to hearing a little bit about the book later. But before we do that, we are going to talk about Bumblebee. Taking us back to the year 1987, Bumblebee the Autobot seeks refuge in a junkyard in a small California beach town. Charlie, on the brink of turning 18 years old and trying to find her place in the world, soon discovers the battle-scarred and broken Bumblebee. When Charlie revives him, she quickly learns that this is no ordinary yellow Volkswagen. Before we get started, I'd just like to remind you that this podcast is rated S for spoilers. But Troy, let's just dive in. What did you think of Bumblebee?
I thought it was entertaining. It was fun. I took my younger son, and he had a good time. So that was a good for him.
Okay, I have to ask then, how old is your younger son? Because I'm debating. My son is 8 years old, and I'm not sure how I feel about bringing him to this one, but it is the closest to any of the other films that they've released. I don't know.
Yeah, he's 15, so he's a little bit more versed in some movies than others. But as opposed to the first Transformers movie, I would have felt uncomfortable taking him to that one.
Oh, no question. No question. I have to admit that for me, 10-year-old Steve was very excited to see this movie. You know, I always was a huge fan of the show when I was a kid. You know, this is the classic characters and whatnot. When they released the first film, I think it was back in 07, I kind of liked it. Like, it was kind of cool to hear the Optimus Prime voice and whatnot. But after that, even, they just got worse and worse. And that one was bad enough as it was.
I enjoyed it on various levels. I'm glad they kept it kid-friendly in a lot of ways. They didn't spend a lot of time with relationship building between the boy and the girl. I mean, there's a relationship there, but it's mostly friendly. So it's not a point where parents have to get guarded, I suppose.
Right. I noticed a huge difference in the way that relationships are portrayed in this film as opposed to any of the other ones. You know, Michael Bay, I always say, is a 12-year-old boy trapped in a 50- or 60-year-old man's body, but not necessarily in a good way.
Yeah, I think he lets his id out a little too much.
Yeah, I think in the first one, I think there's even a moment where Bumblebee is supposed to be peeing on somebody or lubricating, as they say, releases oil.
Yeah, it was just strange the way that they treated the girl in the first one. I mean, all those things I just really struggled with. This one, she's just a girl. She's allowed to be a girl. She makes mistakes. I don't know. I just really enjoyed how they treated her. I didn't feel that they made her like an object or anything like that. They kept clothes on her, you know, all those sorts of things that I think a lot of parents are concerned about. None of that happens in this film. At least I didn't feel like it did.
No. Well, and at one point too, when she is driving away from her friend, who I cannot think of his name. What is his name?
Mimo.
Yeah. When she's standing with Mimo and she kisses him on the cheek and he goes, "You kissed me." And she goes, "Yeah, on the cheek." And he goes, "It still counts." Michael Bay has this way of objectifying women, even just by walking them on screen. This film just wanted to tell you a story with these particular characters, which I thought was so charming.
It was very playful and it was enjoyable. I just liked it.
Yeah, you know, it was funny because, you know, and this is where I guess I said 10-year-old me really got excited, is even the fact that they're using old models of the Transformers. Optimus Prime was the same one I grew up with. When the cassette tape bursts out of Soundwave's chest and he refers to him as Ravage, I got chills. Or at least my innocent child Steve did. But you know what? As I believe, this was produced by Spielberg as well. The other ones were, but this felt more like a classic Spielberg film than the other ones ever have.
I agree. There's this 80s flavor when Spielberg dips his finger in. It just goes back there. It's so strange.
It's funny. This film really went out of its way, I think, to remind you it took place in the 80s.
Yeah.
Not just from the nostalgia, but just from, you know, all of a sudden they're drinking Tab.
Oh, sure.
But no, I felt that there was an innocence to this film that has been lost by so many of the other iterations. And I thought there was something really almost joyful about the film. You know, it felt like E.T. or Iron Giant. Again, I think they were produced by Spielberg.
Yeah, and I think that there's some interesting connections with all those kinds of films, actually.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, for me, you know, I watch a movie like this, and I find it interesting where you have a teenager who is dealing with an issue or problem. Hers is her dead father, and she can't seem to connect with her mom, the new guy in the life of the mom, her brother. She seems disconnected from them, and a surrogate has to come in, and I see that in a little bit of E.T., a little bit of Iron Giant. I see that in these movies where the surrogate has to come in to sort of fill that gap for a while until they can reconnect, perhaps, hopefully, later on. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. That makes a ton of sense. And I think in all of those cases, too, what you see is that surrogate is a little broken themselves. In Bumblebee's case, it's literal. But, you know, the E.T. needs to go home. Bumblebee has lost his memory, but there's a purity and an innocence to his character. In some ways, he's missing his father, as well, if you look at Optimus Prime as having that sort of role.
Definitely.
That's a good place to ask the question then, Troy. One of the things that keeps coming up in this particular film is the idea of letting go. I was wondering what you think it means to let go, and how does the film portray it?
That's an interesting question, because what do we let go of, right? Mm. And for her, for Charlie, you know, I it's hard to say, because I don't think she wants to let go of her father necessarily, but she wants to let go of something about him. Mm. And so, because of her brokenness and Bumblebee's brokenness, they both need to go through a fixing process. They sort of fix each other. And in that, you know, we have the scene at the end for us where she jumps off the cliff, so to say. And I don't know if I would phrase it as letting go. I think that she needs to bring something in. She's sort of blocking things out. She doesn't want to go past this wall of her memory, so to say. And that's the thing that she's holding on to, is this memory of the past. And she really just needs to let it move through her and work in her life, so to say. I don't know if I'm being clear.
No, if I hear what you're saying correctly, it sounds like what you're talking about is letting go is a little bit different than holding on or being blocked, because she may be afraid that moving forward involves her somehow letting go of her father entirely, like his memory doesn't matter anymore.
Yes, it seems like that in some way, like she's, it's almost like she's stuck in time, so to say. Like she doesn't want to dive anymore because that's her last good memory of her dad. And as if she continues with that, then that would make that memory less.
Yeah. And it's, I think she actually says to her mother at one point something to the effect of, you know, I know that everybody else in this house has moved on, but I haven't.
Right.
If I'm right, when she's yelling at her mother, it's something, it's similar to that. There's this comment that seems to suggest that, well, mom may have forgotten about him because she's moved on to Ron. And on a side note, why is it always new boyfriends are named Ron? if it's an unlikable new stepfather, it just seems to be named Ron. Anyways, no offense to any listeners that may be named Ron. Much love.
Here come the emails.
Yeah, that's right. You can email us at Troy Kinney at... No, I'm kidding. this is the line. You found a replacement for my dad and I haven't, if I've written it down. It seems to be like she's afraid that moving on is somehow erasing what's come behind.
Yes.
A fear of moving forward. Like you said, the diving is sort of hindered by this ability or inability to let her love for her father sit and let her father's death rest, in a manner of speaking. It's sort of this way we grieve.
Mm-hmm.
Bumblebee, in some ways, I think, was sort of mirroring that. I thought that his journey was actually kind of interesting because he was moving on his new life on Earth and was unable to process, although literally, because he had no memory, what had happened on Cybertron. But it was interesting that both of them sort of come in wounded by their past in a way that sort of keeps them from moving forward. There's this beautiful moment at the end where he says, "Thank you for giving me my voice." And she says, "Thank you for making me feel like me again." Like there's sort of this piece of her that she allows herself to access, and it's her love for her father and carrying that with her forward, which I think is so beautiful.
I think that she finds that in loving Bumblebee, if that makes any sense. Like it's almost like her love was pent up. Like it couldn't, that's the part that can't go farther, because she loved her dad so much and he passed away. I think that she feels like her love has sort of ended. Like, this is it. I don't know how I'm going to get through my life. But she finds this connection with Bumblebee, and which is something that she has desired, a car, this freedom. And that freedom, her loving, actually brings her that freedom, if that makes sense.
Hmm. Once she learns how to love again, it opens her up to so much more of her life, and it's kind of a strange layer to think about that with Bumblebee when you think about it. But her relationship with her father is so much centered around that car. And again, of course, at the end of the film, what does she do? The first thing she does is finish the car.
Mm-hmm.
Through her relationship with Bumblebee, she allows herself to love others again in a way that it's life-giving.
Correct. And because of that, she's able to fix the other car. She's able to move on in her life in all other ways. And because the other thing, too, is I don't think Ron, this stepdad, boyfriend, whatever he was, I don't think he ever tried to replace her dad.
Hmm.
he actually seemed like a pretty good guy in a lot of ways. I think he was actually trying. I think Mom is trying, but I don't think she sees any of those things. She's so blocked off from that. But when she allows herself to move forward, she's able to fix the other car that she's been working on for years. She's able to move on in her life and her relationships, all those other things.
Yeah. Her parents are, they seem like good people. They just don't know what to do.
Right.
Which I appreciate.
I appreciate that because sometimes parents aren't painted in that picture, but these parents, or at least the mom and Ron and even the brother, they all seemed fairly supportive. There was not this weird sort of crazy animosity and jealousy or hate. I didn't feel any of that in the family portion of it, which I also appreciated.
There was something healthy about the family in this one, I think. Almost stable, even in the midst of their brokenness, there was a stability. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I appreciate about the film, too, as we talk about Charlie, is the argument that goes on about Bumblebee himself. And, as the military are trying to take him down, they keep referring to him about stripping him for parts. He's a robot. He's this thing. And at one point, Charlie screams out, "He's more human than you'll ever be."
Uh-huh.
So I was wondering what is it about Bumblebee that makes him so human?
I've been wondering that myself because the surrogate thing that happens, this idea that he comes in as this machine, but we understand him as having feelings. He's sentient in some way. I don't know. That's an interesting question.
That was the heart of the show when I was a kid. That was it. You know, everybody liked the robots fighting, but the heart of the show was the relationship between the bots and the humans.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this human element to the bots that you could connect to, which I found they really brought in with this particular film. Like, even in the Michael Bay films, even Bumblebee, who's, everybody says, oh, he's the kid, he's kind of a brat.
Mm-hmm.
But this one, he's just, he's childlike in so many ways. You know, the wounded bird that you want to take into your house.
They established that very early on when she gets him to the garage. And just her raising her voice and those kinds of things. He sort of crouches in the corner, which makes us feel for him, which makes us feel that, he has feelings. And so we start to see him more human than not.
Hmm. You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting about this particular iteration is that he's a peacekeeper. He will fight, but the first words he utters before his voice box gets ripped out is, "You misunderstand, I don't want to hurt anyone." He wants to help. Now, of course, that's always been in the Transformers sort of lore where they want to protect the humans. But how many times in the film does she yell at Bumblebee about not wanting to fight? You know, there's two or three times, I think, where they say, "Why aren't you fighting back, Bee? You need to fight back. You need to do something." And I think there's something in Bumblebee which is different in this one than the earlier versions. Because in the other ones, it was the cartoon, and this is really reading into it. The cartoon was really a Cold War cartoon. You know, you had your two sides, evil and good. It was the same as G.I. Joe with giant robots. It was the same. Yeah. You know, this was Thundercats was the same thing. This was my generation. Every show had two very clear sides that were at war with one another, and who makes the first move? Which. It makes sense in the 80s. This one, I mean, Bumblebee's technically a scout. Like, isn't that what his job is in this one? He's just to sort of explore the planet, is he not?
A little bit. But Optimus Prime makes that comment at the end about him protecting the planet.
That's true. That's true.
So there is a little bit of him that is, I think, meant to be a guard as well as a scout, if that makes sense.
That's good that you said that. I think guard is the word that I like because that's different than warrior. I mean, he can fight. He is a warrior.
Correct. I would say that for sure.
Yeah, I love that aspect of it. I thought that was really interesting. And I think that was one of the aspects that makes him so human, is there's this element of this element of innocence and love to Bumblebee that makes him not a towering monster. Like, I guess people love the Hulk, but he's kind of a beast.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, they love certain aspects of the Hulk, but certain aspects it's not. But with Bumblebee, it's different. I mean, and you want to talk about the protective aspect, like you think about the car chase scene when you have Mimo and Charlie and they're, being chased, and Bumblebee is reforming himself to always protect those two in his compartment at all times, even as he, goes through the tunnel and around and blows things up and all that kind of stuff. He is their protector, and he sees that as a very important thing.
Yeah, there's a real value of human life. Bumblebee seems to know how to love, and I think that's what separates him. You know, with John Cena's character, who I liked more than I thought I would. You know, John, he
learns a little.
He does. He does.
He learns a little.
All B has to do is stop a helicopter from crashing into a wall. John Cena learns. But you're right, he does learn. He does learn. And I think he starts to see some value in Bumblebee that none of the others have been able to do. Where they sort of land on the human thing is, again, landing on love.
Yeah, and I think that they built the contrast large when they had the Decepticons just annihilate people into liquid. Just their complete disregard for human life really sets them apart from Bumblebee's character and what he's trying to do.
Yeah, they Men in Black them.
Yes, they did.
That was the moment where I said, okay, this is too much for my 8-year-old. But I was like,
yeah.
Dang. It was like popping a water balloon.
Yeah, unless they make that comment. I like the way they pop. And I was just like, whoa. I was a tiny little bit shocked when it happened the first time. I did not expect that. But
to be fair, and to anyone who hasn't seen the film that is listening right now, it isn't bloody.
No.
It's not gore. It's literally like a water balloon goes off on screen. Like, it's like goo.
Yep.
That was about the most violent, kid-friendly death I've ever seen.
Yeah. Because it's like you said, it's not bloody at all. It's just they just disappear into a goo. So, yeah.
You know what I thought was interesting? And I don't know whether I'm reading too much into this or not, but I loved the Decepticons creating the internet.
I got that, too.
There's this like internal web thing, but it's interesting because like it's the villains that create the internet. I don't want to hate on the internet because hey, that's how your people are listening to us right now.
Sure. Yeah, there definitely seemed to be a little bit of a message there.
There's like complete disregard, and it's all people, you know, it's like, oh, you know what matters is power. That's what we need, you know, whether it's military power, authoritative power, or just knowledge is power. Look at what we can do. You know, we're standing on the shoulder of innovative greatness. And our heroes are the ones that are listening to Never Gonna Give You Up on cassette, you know. I thought it was very interesting. They sort of put a negative technological spin on a movie about giant attacking robots.
But yes. Well, John Cena and his commanding officer do make a comment at that point, like, well, we're just going to take them apart anyway, and then we'll just use what they gave us.
Yeah. But it's interesting. I think John Cena at one point is the only voice of reason. You know, they're sitting around the table and they're saying, oh, you're right. These satellites are great. And he's like, they're literally called Decepticons. Am I the only one?
I agree. That was a good point he made, actually.
I thought to myself, I thought, what? Yeah, listen to John Cena. Like, what's wrong with you guys? That's a sentence I never thought I'd say, but guys, like, come on.
Yeah.
He wants so badly to be The Rock. I know he does.
I felt the same way. I felt that in the movie a few times. Like, I know he wants to be The Rock. I know it. I literally thought that.
He'll get there. I think that there is a really interesting voice in this one that celebrates the value of life and of wholeness in the depth of our hearts that I appreciated. Like, this is the story of the film is very, very simple. Like, it didn't need to be super colossal. You know, I know that Michael Bay wanted to bring in, like, Unicron in the last one where the entire world transforms. But I think ultimately the success of this film rests on the fact that it's about heart and it's about love and how that can change a life.
And I agree with you. And I think all too often these movies, especially when you're dealing with sequels, and I think unfortunately, we kind of see it in the Marvel world right now. Everything has to become bigger. How many millions of bad guys do I need? Do I need 1,000,002 or 3 million? Or is the story something else? Is it somewhere else? And you can go to almost any series of stuff. Like, I think Star Trek New Generation did it too, where it's not just the Enterprise, it's the planet, it's these 10 planets, it's the universe, it's beyond. Yeah. It just becomes this it's so broad spanning that it just can't work anymore. And if we have stories like this where we have Bumblebee, we have a girl, we have a boy who likes her, we have a couple of bad guys, we know who to focus on. We know what to think. We can process our thoughts. Whereas if it's, oh, well, it's 1,000,000 bad guys, I don't even know what to think anymore. Like, what do I do? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I agree completely, because there's a tendency, the worst sequels are the ones that think the spectacle is what people are going to see. There are some that want to see the spectacle, but if it doesn't have a story or a heart to choose or root for, then you're not going to want to see it. I remember years ago, obviously it was years ago, Roger Ebert came to Toronto for book signing. And this was, you know, well after he'd had his stroke and his wife was there. And it was just in this little bookstore here in Toronto. And I went and there was a bit of a Q&A. And I remember I got the chance to ask Roger Ebert, what is it that he looks for in a film? What is the thing that makes a film good for him? And his answer was so simple. He said he's looking for hope. If it doesn't have hope, then why am I investing my time, is basically what his point was.
Interesting.
I thought that was really powerful. And I think you look at a film like this and you compare it to the ones that have come before, and there were five. Let's not forget, this is like the sixth one.
Yeah.
And while I would say that the first one I liked at the time, the rest became unwatchable. Like, they're just bad movies.
Yeah.
But Bay was obsessed with spectacle. He's always obsessed with spectacle.
Yeah. That's what I struggle with his films because of that. Because it's like, you have these broad sweeping things, but you're not developing anything. You just have a cool camera angle or a cool fight scene, but you're not putting anything together. You're not building on anything. This one, we did. We had character development. We had people that mattered and people that cared for other people, and all those kinds of things were in this movie. It felt more human. I mean, that's your question from earlier.
Linking of this and going to Marvel, when you looked at Iron Man and how they started up for the Avengers, every film wanted you to care about its heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you saw happen with sort of DC there for a while, and I haven't seen Aquaman yet, ironically, as we're doing this one, it came out the same weekend and totally crushed it at the box office. I don't know whether it's good or not. Yeah. But, I mean, you look at what happened with DC, and they tried to force it. They're like, oh, we got to get to the Justice League. We got to get caught up. So let's put... Let's put Batman and Superman in the same movie, and people will come to see that, and then they'll do this thing. But they lost the sort of character stories that I think really make give something its value. If they had started with this film and built from there, I think they could have gotten the spectacle. But I do think that they would have just – it would have taken their time and people would have been more invested because it's a beautiful film. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, and I would tell people don't not go see it based on the other films.
Yeah.
That they should definitely go see this, check it out.
You know, it's funny, thinking of Aquaman again, which I haven't seen, I was surprised that they put this film and that film up against each other on the same day. I think, and this is just my personal opinion, I'm willing to bet that they said, well, DC's getting killed by anything that isn't named Wonder Woman. So we'll go there and we'll steal the money. You know, people will say, oh, well, but then they'll get this great press for this movie and we'll take them out. But, you know, you put two juggernauts and somebody's going to lose. And financially, this one didn't even come close. I hope it has staying power because it's really a solid action film for families.
Sure.
I'm showing my hand when I say this, Troy, but why don't we screen it or skip it? Bumblebee, screen it or skip it?
I would say screen it for sure. Go see it.
Yeah.
It's a worthy watch. I think that it's enjoyable. I think that people will come out happy. I think they'll be happy throughout it. It's got good stuff.
Yeah. And I think you're right before to say don't judge it based on the other films.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an absolute screen it for me. I know that it's Oscar fair time, and so is different people looking for different things. But it is a lovely film that, you know, my kid's a little young to go, I think, at this point. But you can bring your 10-year-old, your 12-year-old, I think.
Sure.
Go see it, and I thought there was a lot to like. It was really great film.
Agreed.
Well, Troy, thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate it. Watching Movies, Watching Stories is available now. Is it out on Amazon? Can you grab a copy?
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon in paperback. It's also Kindle Unlimited, so if you have an unlimited account, you can read it for free.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the book? I would love to know what the book's about and why it was so exciting for you to put it together.
Yeah, it's a challenge to talk about the book. Only because it's its own little genre, I suppose. I don't know how to explain it, but I think people really do like visual media. I think that they like movies. I think these new TV shows that run for episode after episode, like Breaking Bad, I think these are super well produced, awesome, movie type things. And so what I've kind of done is sort of taken a lot of film elements and I tried to break them down for the layman just so that we can watch movies a little bit better. People are afraid. They're like, oh, I'm not going to enjoy movies anymore if I read your book. I'm like, no, that's not what it is. It actually opens movies up to you. The response I get from people is like they start watching movies better. If that makes any sense. And so if you read the book, it has QR codes or links to the video clips that I'm talking about. So, for instance, you know, if I have a chapter on camera angle, how does that affect us? How does that make us feel? Because that's what we go to movies for. We go to movies so that we are essentially manipulated. We want to laugh. We want to cry. We want to be angry. How do they do that to us? And in a lot of ways, camera angle, sound, focus, all these things do that to us. And so we enjoy that. But how are they doing that? So that's kind of, I spend a little time on those. But what I do is I put live film clips in the book so you can see what I'm talking about. Because to watch a whole movie and to pull those things out is very hard.
Yeah.
It's very sweeping and huge, but if I can just pull a film clip out and, for instance, show you, you know, Rocky running up the steps and the effect that has when you talk about the music, because that step scene happens twice in the first Rocky movie, and each scene has a different feel to it. And so they're doing this on purpose. And so we sort of see these sort of things that happen. And so I put those in there. And then the second half of the book is more thematic, like certain themes we see a lot in films, in stories, all those kinds of things, like repeated ideas or movies that have been made again. Like, why is a movie made so many times? Like, The Magnificent Seven has been made almost seven times over and over again. Why is that movie so important that we see it? You know, I mean, it's The Seven Samurai, it's The Magnificent Seven, it's A Bug's Life, it's Three Amigos. They remade The Magnificent Seven a couple of years ago. Those are all the same movie. Why is that storyline so important to us? Why do we need to see that so many times? So I discuss things like that in the book.
Oh, that's cool. Well, and A Star Is Born, of course, right now. This is like the fifth iteration of it over, you know, 80 years.
Yeah.
What do you mean when you say to watch films better? You've said that a couple of times. What does it mean to watch a film better?
That's a great question. I guess I say that a lot. understanding, in a sense, what the movie maker is doing so that we can, one, appreciate it, and two, so that we can, see it, understand it, talk about it. If you understand what that is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's something powerful about story that sort of connects us. One of the things you were saying, you and I were talking about before, is that we're all watching the same films, and but we're not really engaging them. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's part of what I'm saying. I think that people like to talk about the plot and the characters, maybe an action scene. I want to take it to the next level, so to say, the next step, and say, okay, we had all of that. Why did they do it? What was the point of the movie? Why are they telling, like The Magnificent Seven, why are they telling this story over and over again? Why are people demanding this? Well, because we see an oppressed people, and we see people come in to help them. These are good things. These are things that we like to see happen in our world. So I think that, you know, when we look at a movie and it's sort of its meta story, like, what is it really telling us about who we are? Because those are the movies that last. Those are the books that last. The stories that last are the ones that are touching us as human beings and say, this is what humanity is about. And so if we can do that and understand what it is that's happening, I think that makes a huge difference. And again, it allows us to connect not just to the film but to each other and say, you know what? I really like that Bumblebee was made like a human being. There was something about him that helped Charlie, the character, move on in her life because she found her love again. She found her ability to do those things. That touches us as a human being and says, that's what's important.
I like that you talk about it, the things that show us about who we are and connects us. I think that's powerful. I think there's solid truth there. And certainly that's what things are based on with Screenfish as well. So we totally understand what you're talking about in that sense.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we talk about things like sacrifice. People come from another place to connect with us. They sacrifice. They just, I don't know, these things are super important to people. When we see this happen, it's just amazing. And that's sort of always the connection I'm trying to make, like with students and stuff, is let's not get wrapped up in these things that are really hard. Like, Shakespeare can be hard, but what is Shakespeare? What is the heart of Shakespeare? What is it talking about that makes it last so long? Why are people still spending money on Shakespeare movies, making them or using their plots, you know, because there's something about it that's human.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Troy. I think stories are powerful in a way that reveal the depth of who we are and what we think about the world. And I think it's a great place, launchpad, for us to talk about those sorts of things. That's why I'm okay with remakes, actually. It's fascinating to see seven different stories of Seven Samurai or five different stories of A Star Is Born, because each one of them has to be different. They're all a product of their culture.
Sure. I agree.
Is there anything else that that you want to say about the book per se, or anything you want to do to pump it up?
Just buy it, tell people about it. I think that everybody that, people that that have read it have told me they've really enjoyed it. It's a little addicting, to be honest, because you see the next QR code. You can't help but see the next one. So you just read a little bit because you want to see what the next movie clip is. I have movie clips in here from over 90 different movies. I try not to be movie specific so that you can watch any film and look for these things. And it will literally enhance the way that you watch movies. I think you'll appreciate film a lot better. I think you'll appreciate what's happening on the screen. There's times when I wonder, how are they doing these things? And it amazes me. So I think that for me, it just makes the whole experience more rich. And if I can, I saw They Shall Not Grow Old.
You saw that. I've heard that's incredible. What did you think?
I really enjoyed it. But here you have Peter Jackson, who, in all intents and purposes, this guy is a genius. He's kind of a slob a little bit, but he's a super genius. He was, he's given these films, these old World War I films, and what he was able to do with them is almost miraculous. They're so crisp and clear. He said at one point that he was able to zoom in on some of the shots. And so as I was watching the movie, I couldn't understand how they were getting these camera movements, because I know what's going on. You have a guy on a tripod turning a crank by hand in the middle of a field. And so it was interesting because I'm watching the movie and all of a sudden the camera makes a movement that I'm like, how are they doing that? Well, he said that they were able to clarify the film so much that they were actually able to zoom in on it and move the zoom. They were able to pan across. And so what that creates is camera movement. And it was super interesting because I'm thinking, how are they doing this? And that's how they were doing it. He took a still shot and he was able to use a little camera magic, a little movement technique, a little zoom, and create a cinematic effect. And so he takes some liberties with the film by colorizing it. He even added sound to a lot of it, actual like mud sounds and gunshot sounds and these things, and he creates sort of a cinematic feel to the movie.
Wow.
But he also does something else interesting. He has no narrator. The narration of the movie is the World War I veterans of the time. They have over 600 hours of them speaking about the war. So he takes their talking. That's the narration, is these actual men that were there on the front talking about their experiences. It was something else.
Wow, that's unreal. I've heard that movie is just phenomenal, and it's not a film that's going to be like shown in theaters. It's sort of touring, I think.
Yeah, it had two dates here in the States. Yesterday was the last date here. I'm assuming it's going to go to a streaming service or PBS or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I'd love to see that. I've heard remarkable things. I really, truly have.
Anyway, real quick about my book. I try to span years. I have black and whites. I got silent films. I got newer films. I got all kinds of stuff in the book so that you're sort of prepared for anything that comes along, so to say.
Wow, that's cool. That's cool. All right. Here's a very simple question for you. Is there a film, let's just pick one year, we'll pick 2018, that you felt impacted you the most or was so well made that you felt like everybody had to be talking about it?
Oh my goodness gracious, that's not an easy question at all.
It's one year. I could have said ever.
That's a hard question because I also saw The Mule the other night and I'm still working that one over in my head.
I'm excited about that one. I miss Gran Torino. So I was excited about The Mule.
Yeah, because there's a little thing that I say, like, sometimes I go into a movie on Monday and I don't come out until Thursday. So the mule's working me over a little bit. As far as other films, I did really appreciate the Netflix series The Haunting of Hill House. I thought that was okay. Really well done. Which is not technically a movie, but no. I thought they did a spectacular job. And I like that a lot.
All right, I'll check that one out. A horror isn't my thing, but I hear it's actually really well written.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd put it in horror category. It's not gory, it's spooky. And okay. and I say that in the sense that it's really spooky in the sense of, like, ghosts and stuff like that, but you're not going to have anybody get hacked up in that movie.
Okay.
Bird Box, on the other hand, it has some violent scenes. Like, wow, like that was pretty violent. This one, Haunting of Hill House, is more haunting-like. So a lot of dark rooms, and they do some camera stuff in it. It's so amazing. There's one of the episodes that's almost a continuous shot. They don't cut. And it's spectacular. It's just amazing to watch that.
Cool. And we take that under advisement. Troy, thanks so much for chatting with us. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. Hope you'll come back on. This was great. And a reminder for you at home, you can find us hopefully wherever you find your podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Podomatic, there's a whole bunch, SoundCloud. If you go to the website, screenfish.net, and go to the podcast page, you can download Fishing for More, which can be some questions, small group questions that you can have about the film with people that you saw it with or people you know were interested in Bumblebee. And we will be back, I think, in 2 weeks with our first film. This was our last episode of 2018, which is obvious because the year is over. But we will be back soon with an episode on Mary Poppins Returns with Kevin McLenathan from Seeing and Believing. We're excited to have Kevin back on as well. But Troy, thanks again for coming on. And
if I could just plug real quick, my website, www.troykinney.com. And I also have a blog. I talk about movies and various other things on there as well.
Oh, okay, there you go. TroyKinney.com and his blog. You can check that out. And for you at home, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.